Welcome all sports fans. On this podcast,
no sport is left behind.
I'm Justin Williams.
I'm Cabrera Duran, and this is our brother from Down Under.
Me, Wallace Bruce.
We are the Pro Sports Podcasters.
Filling you in on the latest news from the world of sports.
On this episode of the Pro Sports Podcasters, we talk with mixed martial artist Slippery Pete Barrett. And then Justin and I discuss the recent flurry of serious injuries occurring in the octagon. Let's get right to it. Welcome to the Pro Sports Podcasters. I'm Cobe, and today I've got NWB with me. Nee, how you doing?
I'm good, Cobe. Good to be with you.
And we also have a special guest. He is an MMA fighter with a Muay Thai background, and he trains at a Mark Deligrati's gym. Has a professional record of 11-5 as a featherweight. He is the Slippery Pete Barrett. Pete, how you doing?
I'm great, man. Just sitting back, enjoying my coffee here on this nice Sunday morning.
Okay, so now going to jump right into it. With COVID, it's been hard for a lot of fighters to get fights. When was your last fight?
My last fight was December 8th.
December 8th, okay. And do you have anything scheduled coming up?
I do. I'm actually the main event on the first show in Massachusetts since the lockdown, which is June 19th.
That's got to be awesome. You're going to fight in front of your home crowd?
Oh, I can't wait.
And they're going to have a full stadium?
No. Massachusetts is about 6 months behind the rest of the country. We still have mask mandates, limited restrictions, and all that jazz. So I believe there will only be about 300 tickets sold to the event.
So a very small group.
Yes. Yep. So right now where Massachusetts is only allowed to have pro sporting events. So all the amateurs are shit out of luck and they're going to do a small card with five or six pros coming up here in about 4.5 weeks. And then he's actually thinking about going up to New Hampshire to do an amateur show unless Governor Baker changes his tune with restrictions and whatnot.
Okay. So your contract with the UFC has expired?
They released me after my last fight with Chase Hooper, which, you know, I kind of saw that coming, you know, even like 30 seconds after the bell had rung. That's kind of where that wash of emotion came from.
Yeah.
But, you know, they said, hey, if you go put together a streak, we'll have you back. And, you know, just let us know when you get a couple fights going your way. So, you know, I got that email a couple months ago and I've been just getting my knee ready from that last Chase Hooper fight. I hurt my ACL with that heel hook.
From the heel hook, yeah.
Rehabbing that, getting that nice and strong. Staying in the gym, staying ready. And I think it was about a month and a half ago, I was able and ready to, I was at a point where I was comfortable taking a fight. And I've just been busting my ass ever since.
Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Like, not many of us can say that we fought in the UFC, but you've done that. And you also won Dana White's Contender Series. Take us through that.
Yeah, I mean, the Contender Series was a trip. It was a really eye-opening experience. I had a blast, you know, like, you don't get the full UFC treatment when you fight on the Contender because technically it's not a UFC product. It's a Dana White product, but they still bring you in-house and you know, show you kind of like a glimpse of what's capable if you do get to that next level. So it was really refreshing to see, to have all the support and just to see what like that next level looks like. But the Contender was a wild ride, you know, like I'm not a spring chicken by any means. I'll be 35 this summer. So I think I was 33 when I got on the Contender, and even then they told me I was too old to get on there, but they had this kid from South Korea that nobody wanted to fight because he was just a bad matchup. The kid was a monster, you know, like he was a giant. And, you know, I fight at 45 and at 55, but I'm a bigger, you know, stronger opponent at 45. So, you know, back to what I was started with, we knew that this was going to be my only shot into the UFC, so it didn't matter who was across the cage, I was taking the fight. It just so happened to be this kid, Sang-hun Yu, who had a small MMA record, 5-0, I think 5 finishes. But what I didn't know is that he had like 100+ Sanshu kickboxing fights before he went into MMA, which I guess some of the other people must have known him, which is why he wasn't getting matched easily. But the cool part about that is I heard that announced like as I was walking my way into the cage, they were announcing his stats. And I'm like, oh, he's had over 100 of these fights. I'm like, makes sense why nobody wants to fight him. Let's go. And whether that was my coach's, you know, whether that wasn't advocated to me or they just didn't know, I'm not sure. But, you know, I found out walking in there. And then, you know, once doing a little bit of homework, I realized that this kickboxing style that he was really good with was pretty much kickboxing with takedowns. And, you know, in hindsight, throwing that liver kick right there off the rip was probably a bad idea. But yeah, man, the Contender Series was a trip, man. So best part, getting the contract, getting my name called. The worst part, right, is as I'm waiting to get out to the cage, they have you sitting in this holding area where they play your intro. So the producers know when to send you to walk to the cage.
Yeah.
Now, if you remember my intro, it was like, it was a heart wrencher. I was talking about my brother who had just passed away, my dad who had just passed away, battling through depression, overcoming that. And I'm sitting right in front of this TV and I look at all these awesome people. I go, hey, can we turn this TV off? I really don't want to listen to this right now.
That's right.
And they go, no, you know, we need to keep it on because that's when we know when to send you. I go, okay, can you turn it down so I don't have to listen to it? She goes, unfortunately, we're waiting for something that you say so we know when to send you. And I'm like, motherfucker. So right before that fight, I'm in my feels. I'm in my emotions, thinking about my dad, thinking about my brother, thinking about losing those last three fights because I was drinking like an asshole behind the scenes and hiding everything. And I'm like, well, this is just, you know, one more hurdle in the way of getting there. So I threw some headphones on. I started rocking out to Notorious B.I.G., Hypnotize. And I'm like, fuck this. We got to change this, you know, pull a little alchemy, get this emotion going in the right direction. And that's why I blew through the doors all fired up because, like, I had to drag myself out of it. Not drag myself, but get my head out of that dangerous state where I was just, like, revisiting all those terrible emotions that I just worked through.
Yeah, that's like quicksand. That's going to slow you right down.
And if you see me come out, you know, that first round, like, I was super tense coming out, you know, in the beginning of the first round. Like, he threw a kick, I ripped a kick right away versus, like, kind of, you know, not getting so caught up. But once I got, like, I said, how do I like to say it? You know, once I blew my load and he fucking got on top of me, put me in the crucifix and teased with a TKO, once I shook that, I was, like, back to smiling, back to laughing, back to having a good time. But, like, the first 30 seconds of that fight, I was, like, cortisol's running, fight or flight, like, ah, these emotions are killing me right now. But like I said, once I got that out, was able to shake him off, get out of that nice little arm bar he had there, I was really able to just get back to my groove.
No doubt. So, I mean, that's a story of overcoming adversity. And it sounds like you're doing the same again, coming back from the ACL tear and got the upcoming fight. The goal is to get back to UFC. Would you say that you've had to overcome even more adversity during this COVID time?
Some of the adversity that I had with COVID was around my first fight that got canceled that was supposed to be back in Oklahoma last April. I was losing my mind, like, trying to get ready for a fight alone in the gym, like, not alone in the gym, alone in my basement with a heavy bag and some jiu-jitsu mats, you know, like, it was harrowing. When we didn't know what the hell was going on, everybody thought COVID was going to wipe out half of the earth and we were going to be left in some dystopian futuristic movie with God knows what running around at this point this year. You know what I mean? So, like, once everything kind of came back to normal as far as, like, realizing what we were dealing with, when I, like, my fight camp for Zalal was pretty normal. And then my fight camp for Hooper was, you know, as normal as I think it was going to get. So once I had my coming to Jesus moment when I was supposed to fight back in April, I realized that, you know, I can't really waste any energy or emotion on the things I can't control, and I just need to focus on the things that I can. So thankfully, that was a lesson I got out of the way real quick with COVID. But the 2 months thought I was fighting, training alone, running, doing road work, not hitting pads, you know what I mean? That was the adversity. But I definitely came through that on the other side good, positively, ready to fight and whatnot. But COVID's been crazy, man.
No doubt about that.
Yeah, so you train under Mark Deligrotti.
I do.
And I mean, that's a name I hadn't heard in a while. And I've been a fan of MMA for quite some time. So I remember when he was one of the top striking coaches, period, for the UFC mm-hmm. fighters. Now you don't hear about him as much, although casual fans will recognize him because they saw him in Here Comes the Boom. Mm-hmm. But
yep.
Are you training all styles under him now? Or do you have, say, a new coach that you're looking at? Because, I mean, submission defense has sort of been your weakness, correct?
Yeah, so it was about 2 years ago I got lined up with Joe Lozon. And I mean, I've always been within a Sit Your Tongue affiliate since I started training out here, but in Massachusetts.
Okay.
So the first guy that I was under, he fought under Crew Mark way back in the day. And then I made a lateral move to another guy who also trained and fought under Crew Mark. And then as time progressed, I just moved up to Sit full time.
Yeah.
All the while still up there with the team training, the fight team and doing all that. But you know, my home base wasn't there. Now, City of Tong is my home base. I'm up there, you know, 3 or 4 days a week. But I also, like I had mentioned, I train my jiu-jitsu under Joe Lozon.
Okay.
Since the fight before the contender, Joe Lozon cornered me on my last local fight. And that was like after 4 or 5 months of working with him. I think I started with that the January of that year. And then I fought that July. And then I got on the contender that September.
Okay.
But I've been with Joe for a few years now. And Joe's an awesome guy. He's probably one of the nicest guys I've ever met in MMA. Total like big brother archetype. You know what I mean? He'll give you shit when you need it. He'll tell you the truth when you need it. He'll sit you down and tell you things you don't need to hear. He's definitely not a yes man. But, you know he's got your best interest at heart. Otherwise, he wouldn't have taken the time to tell you the things. You know what I mean? So, and I was telling people this a couple of years ago. You know, this is the first time in history you see the great, like, Joe Lozon and the great, like, Crew Mark in the same corner cornering somebody. So, like, I'm just super grateful that I was able to put that together, too.
Yeah, for people who are relatively new MMA fans, if you want to see some fantastic fights, back and forth battles, look up some of Joe Lozon's earlier fights in the UFC. They're phenomenal. He's had some amazing contests.
Even his last fight in the UFC when he fought in Boston, he took that kid off the contender and fucking... I hope you guys don't mind me swearing. I've been
go ahead, buddy.
So, yeah, right. I feel pretty comfortable, like we're in the trust tree. But the kid that he fought in Boston, the last Boston, right after I fought on the contender. Oh, okay. So, yeah, I mean, the Joe's fight in Boston, the kid was fresh off the contender. He hadn't fought anyone in the UFC yet. Joe pieced him up pretty good. And then from there, that kid's actually turned around and had, you know, a decent performances in the UFC. So it's not like he grabbed him ahead of his time and he was a slouch. Joe went out there and put work on a high level competitor.
Yeah. No, I used to love Joe Lozon's fights, man. I was a huge fan of Lozon. So obviously you're working the ground game with him.
Yeah. I'm over there. We're doing groundwork 3 or 4 days a week. I'm over there 2 hours, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And then I rotate my team training on Saturdays between Siya Tong and Lozon. So I've got this big old fight family and I love them to death.
And their gyms they're holding up well given the situation?
Yeah, Joe just switched locations back in January and I think his membership, like he lost a few people in the move, but his memberships are up. Now that we've relaxed on some of the cohort style training that we've had, I mean, sometimes he's got 40 people in there at 10 o'clock.
Right on. So he's doing well.
He's a great instructor, you know. He's a great father, which you'd be like, what does that have to do with being an instructor? Like, his patience is through the roof. Like, you could ask him the same question 15 times and he'd find 15 different ways to explain it to you. You know what I mean? He's just an awesome, awesome instructor in that regard.
Right on.
Yeah. So, you mentioned cornering, and if I'm not mistaken, you did some cornering recently in Arizona, Pete. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so there's a relatively new thing going on. It's the U.S. Muay Thai Open or Nationals, and there are some other smaller programs out there that, you know, they didn't exist when I was an amateur, but we've got a bunch of amateurs up at Siya Tong. Yeah, so one of our guys, he signed up for the U.S. Muay Thai Open, and it was out in Phoenix, Arizona. And these guys pretty much, the U.S. Muay Thai Open is, I think their first event was 2015, 2016. So it's relatively new. It wasn't around when I was an amateur, but this is a great way to develop amateurs and really get them a taste for fighting before they say, like, get in the cage and they're able to throw elbows and knees without any sort of protection on.
Yeah.
For anybody in the grappling community, I would liken it to a Naga, but for Muay Thai.
Okay.
It's a really cool event. I'm hoping that we can, as a team, moving forward, bring more people to these events. I was talking to some of the other coaches about best ways to game plan and prepare our team for it, but it's just a great opportunity. I mean, you fight, you continue fighting as long as you win. You lose, you're out. But, you know, there was an event in South Carolina a few months ago. There's this past one in Phoenix. There's another one coming up in New York. But they're starting to pop up all over, so that's really cool.
Cool. And I was going to ask you about another promotion. I mean, obviously, your goal is to get back to the UFC. You've already stated that. But what have you thought, or do you know anyone involved in the PFL?
I do. I actually, Kayla Harris was Harrison was training with us at Siya Tong before she made the move down south, because she was a judo product of Jimmy Pedro Sr. and he's located up here in the Boston area. But that really would, you know, that would be on my manager's behalf. You know, I would just ask him to reach out accordingly, because we've had guys like, when I say we, my manager, he put Nate Andrews in PFL last year and a couple other guys. So the connections are there. I just don't know, actually ever pursued it or if the timing was just off where they were picking up their roster and I was already released from the UFC while they were, or I was still contracted with the UFC when they were doing it. But they usually announce like their rosters a couple months ahead of their what they call season.
That's right. Would you be interested in being the PFL or no?
Oh, absolutely. I would love to fight. I mean, what we're seeing right now is that regardless of the promotion, you're seeing high-level fighters at all of them. The UFC is the most mainstream, highly condensed conglomerate of high-level talent, but that's not to say that you don't see the same level of talent in PFL, in Bellator, in ONE FC. It's just that the UFC has the market share, and that's where most casual fans watch.
Yeah, I agree. I used to look at some of the secondary promotions as almost a feeder league into the UFC, but now I see them more kind of on par with a different product on offer. I kind of like the PFL point system because it really promotes that go for the finish mentality, which I think you have, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that I would be lying if bare knuckle wasn't a conversation we had because I have that mentality. You know what I mean? Get in there, okay. Get out fast, throw some heavy bombs and land. I think bare knuckle might be a conversation in a year or two. Once the UFC is completely off my radar, or if I don't make it back to the UFC, you know what I'm saying? I'd like to pursue the highest levels in MMA first, and then I could always retire to bare knuckle, you know what I mean? Just tape up those hands and give somebody the knuckles.
Yeah, throw.
Just drop bombs.
There we go. That's what it's about, dropping bombs. Now, what would you say has been your, I guess, most memorable fight so far?
Memorable? I have like favorite fights for different reasons, but it would have to be the contender fight, you know what I mean? That was like, that was the point in my career where I got acknowledged that my skills were on par to be at the next level. And that kid was a fucking giant. Like, Sang-Hoon Yu came in and he looked like a frail little dude at weigh-ins. And then by the time he got into the fucking cage, I swear that boy had put on about 40 pounds.
His brother showed up, right?
Yes, his bigger, scarier, older, not crossing his legs at weigh-ins, big brother. Like, I'm at weigh-ins and this kid's sitting with his legs crossed. And my girlfriend looks at me and she goes, "Hey, Peter, you see how he's sitting? If he whoops your ass, I'm leaving you." And I'm like, all right, she just put it on. And then when he shows up at the fight, I'm like, dude, did this guy just fill himself up with fucking air? Where did he come from? You know? And I'm sure people look at me the same way when I fight at 145. But I mean, yeah, I mean, that was the extent of, you know, all the adversity I had to get over in the first minutes of that first round to come back to pretty much, you know, people like, "How come you didn't piece him up after you started wrestling?" I'm like, did you think I had any fucking control over my arms after the amount of wrestling I did to hold that ogre down?
Yeah.
Like my arms, after the end of the first round, my arms were smoked. I remember there was being a point in that fight where I'm like, "All right, throw the double jab cross, Peter." And I'm like, "The double jab's not going anywhere. My arm is fucking smoked." And I'm pretty sure it was right after that where he threw like that knee up the middle that he just missed my forehead with. And I was like, "All right, we got to close distance and keep him out of danger range."
All right. I like that. Now, Pete, what's some words of advice you'd pass on to some younger fighters or kids who want to be like you and want to be pro at MMA?
And man, if you want to be like me, there's a lot easier ways to get where I got and quicker too, probably. But, you know, I like to learn everything firsthand. So that's just for me. I would say do your research before you just walk into an MMA gym. There has been a lot of uncovering of these just really strange individuals that open MMA gyms and kind of take advantage of people. And you don't want to fall suspect to that. So do your research and figure out who you're going to be training under before you go sign up for a class. You know what I mean? You don't want to be at the MMA gym that the rest of the community is like, "Oh, those guys drink the Kool-Aid. They're like a little cult." Like, they're good people, they're cool, but they're very culty and they're all like hive-minded and it's kind of scary. So like, do your research about who you're going to go train under. Make sure you're under a vetted black belt or some master of their craft or of their trade. You don't want someone that's kind of good at everything. You want someone that's really good at a few things. Also, I would say as far as an amateur is concerned, look to boxing. Take the good things from boxing and get rid of the rest. That being said, and what I mean with that, let me unpack that. That means you don't have to go out there and fight the toughest guy every single time. You're never going to make it to the next level. That's why a lot of people a lot of the great fighters that you see from local communities never make it because they're wasting their chin on all the toughest fights, whereas they could be developing their skills and their talents by beating people just good enough to work on those things while graduating to the next level of an opponent. Boxers have 100 amateur fights before they go pro. Boxers have 10 to 12 trash can fights before they get a tough pro. You know what I mean? And well, you know, people think, oh, MMA's too tough for that. You know, we're not like that. No, well, that's why nobody makes it to the next level. That's why you only see the really standout guys who are cultured and handled from early on in their career make it to the next level. You know, like, you need to understand that the toughest fights are going to burn out your career sooner than later. So fight the guys that are just good enough for you to work on the things that you need to work on while you accelerate your skills in the room. You can either do it through hard sparring or you can do it through competition. And both are good for their own things, but it's not about fighting the toughest people and it's not about cutting the most weight. Get in there as an amateur. Fuck cutting weight. Tell the promoter, hey, I walk at 170. I want to fight someone else who walks at 170. I don't want someone cutting down from 190. And if you have conversation with promoters like that, you better be able to sell tickets because they're not going to take care of you if you just show up and you don't sell tickets. Selling tickets is a big part of the fighting. And you can really control your career just by being open with the promoters, you know, or with your coach, or making sure you have a good coach. Back to the first thing I said, not a coach that's just going to say, hey, Joe, I've got three guys that are willing to fight. We want tough fights. We'll fight anyone. And then you're getting hand fed to the promotion's golden boys. You don't want that either. I think I just gave three tips. You know, do your research, get under a vetted instructor, and take your time with the fighting. Don't go take the biggest fights right away.
Yeah, I like that. Keeping it real.
So last question I've got for you is, you said you're a pretty big featherweight.
Yes.
So what's your walking around weight?
In camp, 165, 170 is usually where I start to diet from. But, you know, this past COVID season, I got up to like a 180 when I wasn't training for a fight. But I do want to say that was after the knee injury and I wasn't doing much and I was pretty sedentary on the couch.
Yeah. So you can get as high as 180.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then how hard is it for you to lose the weight?
It's funny. I just had this conversation with someone. Everybody says the more you put on weight, the harder it is to lose the weight. It's not hard. How to lose weight is very simple. What's hard is the discipline of doing it every day and making the right decisions. It's a very simple concept. It's a very difficult discipline. It's like 2 + 2 = 4. As long as I look at my equation properly, losing weight's no problem. I just need to give myself enough time to do it. That being said, 6 weeks normally to get to 180 to 145 from 165, 170.
Okay. All right, so you lose 20 pounds in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And what's your fighting weight then? So you weigh in 145 and a half on Friday. Mm-hmm. On Saturday, what do you weigh in?
Wow, 165.
You're right back up.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
160,
shit.
165, easy. Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, you're a big featherweight.
And, you know, but a lot of guys are like that. You know, Josh Emmett, he probably fights at 195 when he fucking comes in. That dude's massive. And I've trained with him in the past when I was out at Team Alpha Male. I went out there and trained for a little bit. And he's, not to get on a tangent, super nice dude, but he's also a massive featherweight.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I like what you said about the losing weight part, the discipline. I think that's one thing that we forget. So that's good.
That's the only thing it is. You know what I mean? Like, you intuitively, you probably know if you should or shouldn't be eating something. It's just having the discipline to say no to it and to reach for something healthier or drink some water instead of eating a snack.
Right. Now, just one last question. I realize time is short, but just before we get you out of here, it's May, and that's Mental Health Awareness Month. And you've touched on a few things today about where you've been resilient, you've overcome adversity, but we're still in COVID in many parts of the world, and the pandemic is taking its toll. So what's some words of advice you'd have for listeners who are going through some stuff right now?
You know, I would say, first and foremost, if you can reach out for help, whether that be to a friend, a family member, you know, if you tell someone that you need to talk and you're having a hard time, most people that love and care for you will just sit there and listen. And then to take that to the next level, do some research, find a therapist that resonates with you. If you need medical help, find a psychiatrist or a shrink, but I would always say go to a therapist first because they're going to have some modalities and some practical things to apply before you would say get a medicine to help you feel better. Small things like daily goals and lists, physically write things out, physically cross them off. That'll give you a nice little boost when you see things accomplished.
Nice.
Get moving, get outside, get walking, walk for 10 minutes a day. Get up in the morning, go walk in the sunshine, get that vitamin D, get your blood moving, get your body moving. Sometimes, you know, sedentary people feel like they might deal with emotions a lot worse. If you look to nature, right, why there's a whole book called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. They get attacked by the biggest cats in the world, right? But they don't have any health issues because, one, they're always moving. When they do get attacked and their cortisol goes through the roof, you'll watch them shake it out. Same thing with dogs. When dogs get spooked, they shake everything out, and that's to release the tension from their muscles. We don't do that. We hold the tension in our muscles, and that's why people have bad backs, bad necks, bad posture. So just get out and get moving. Get in the sunshine, you know. Reach out to someone close if you need to ask for help. And little things like daily goals and lists that you can physically cross off will do wonders.
I like that. I like that a lot. So there we have it. The guy who is a man of many talents, and smashing is his passion.
Hell yeah.
It's all about that. Mr. P. Barrett, we really appreciate your time. Find him on Twitter, at Slippery's World. And why don't you tell the listeners where they can find you on Instagram?
Instagram is at Slippery_Pete145. And if you guys want to check out my website, I just launched a web store with all my merch. That's slipperiesworld.com.
And as Pete mentioned, he'll be fighting in June in Massachusetts, June 14th. So we look forward to seeing you get the W and go on to even greater things.
Awesome, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, man, it was cool talking to you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to join the Pro Sports Podcasters Facebook group where you will be able to interact with the hosts and talk to other sports fans. Now back to the show.
Okay, something people tend to forget when it comes to MMA is although it is a mixed martial art and it's full contact, they are wearing gloves. There is some, you know, additional padding, minimal padding that they wear, but injuries do happen, and for the most part, people like to reference blood sport, and they look at the bloody noses, the cuts, the bruises, and such, and that sort of stands out, and it's what is apparent after the match when you look in the cage. But what people tend to forget is that these guys get real serious injuries as well. Most recently, was it May 15th?
Yes, sir.
And what we have happened there?
So we had the veteran, Ronaldo Souza, versus Andre Muniz. Ronaldo suffered a snapped arm. Okay, so I was watching this and I heard a crack sound. Well, I'm like, whatever, it's UFC. Somebody somewhere might have been close to a mic and maybe cracked a knuckle or hit something. I didn't pay much attention to it because it didn't look that bad. But it wasn't until Ronaldo Souza stood up and his arm was kind of red, as if he got a sunburn. And I was like, what's wrong with his right arm? And then they went... they went back and just, I don't know how, like, shout out to UFC editing crew, but they drowned out the sound of the people. So it was just the fighters. It might have just been the mic of the ref. And you heard the snap pop sound. Oh, shivers, chills everywhere.
Oh, yeah. And after they separated the two fighters, you could tell just by looking at Jacare, he was in a lot of pain. He was a bit shocked, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And on closer inspection, you could see that his arm was sort of bent somewhat the wrong way.
Oh, yeah.
It was obvious that there was a pure break somewhere in there. And yeah, it was basically an arm bar from the bottom. Mm-hmm. And in that position, it's one of those situations where it's very difficult to either tap in time or separate in time. And it's just going to happen. I've seen that happen a number of times back in the day. When people tried the flying armbar more often, it doesn't happen as much anymore because fighters have just gotten wise to how to defend it. Mm-hmm. But in that situation, it wasn't so much a flying armbar. It was just a scramble. And Souza found himself in a weird position. His arm twisted back and then Buddy sunk it in and gravity took over, right? It's one of the reasons why generally gravity submissions aren't really allowed in the UFC. But I mean, they happen by accident.
Right, as this case was. It was complete fluke, just happened. Like, I don't feel like there was ill intent. I don't think...
No.
Yeah, he wasn't trying... He was trying to get the win, but I don't think he was trying to snap Buddy's arm.
No, this wasn't a Husamar Palhares type of fighter, right? I know you're relatively new to MMA as a fan, but people ask me quite often, who do you think was the most vicious MMA fighter ever?
Right.
And I always tell everybody he's still fighting. He's still out there. It's Husamar Palhares, because nobody sinks in a knee bar like Husamar does and cranks it that extra 5 seconds after the tap to do serious damage. Husamar Palhares is quite a good fighter, actually, although he's probably coming to the end of his career now. He spent some time in the UFC, but eventually the UFC, they booted him, not because he had a losing record. They booted him because they wanted to protect the rest of the fighters in his division.
Mm-hmm.
That's how dangerous it was to fight him. But yeah, I feel bad for Jacare. He's one of my favorites of all time. He is toward the end of his career now, so I wouldn't be surprised if he sees this as a reason to call it quits.
I mean, he's, what is he, like 41 or something?
He's up there. I'm not sure his exact age, but he's been through it. He's been in the game a long time. He's fought everybody when it comes right down to it. He was a very scary person to see across the cage for the longest time. Has some deadly Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And that's also why it's kind of ironic that he ends up getting his arm broken to an arm bar, because it's something that he knows how to handle.
So just a little quick thing on the most disgusting MMA fighter, Paul Harris. Just a quick little read there. He's 41 as well. And I was curious. I'm like, okay, so he was released from the UFC for continuously holding on way past. But in the World Series fighting, same thing happened. He held on for far too long. He won the championship belt, but then was stripped of it. Also, the referee said that he was eye gouging quite often during the fight.
Yeah, it literally got to a point where most guys didn't want to fight him.
Yeah.
They didn't want to fight him. And he was so good, knee bars and leg locks and such, that was his strategy to victory. That was it. Mm-hmm. He would come into a fight, and against strikers, didn't matter. He'd take a couple shots to just go for your legs, try and wrap you up quickly. And it's a difficult thing to defend if you don't know 100% of what you're doing.
Right.
Slapping an e-bar and game over. And then you're not fighting for a year because you got to rehabilitate. Right. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me he went on to another promotion and got booted from there as well. I know recently I saw a headline somewhere that he got his ass knocked out. At a very recent event, he got smoked in the first round by somebody.
Yeah, so I'm actually looking at this right now. He faced Gregory Klitsch.
I don't even know who that is.
It's in the Russian fighting game.
Okay.
According to this, he hasn't fought since 2018. He was scheduled to fight somebody, but then COVID happened in 2020.
What's the next most recent injury?
Next most recent injury is Derek Anderson versus Michael Venom Page, and that was a nose break at Bellator 258.
I think nose break is putting it mildly.
Nose flattening?
Yeah. Nose destruction?
Yeah, this gentleman, how do I put this? He needs rhinoplasty, essentially. Not even, that was, oh my God, I can't even, that was gross, but it was fun to watch.
Yeah, Michael Venom Page is one of my favorite mixed martial artists. He's got such an unorthodox style. He's a phenomenal striker. Sometimes he pays the price for not having traditional defense,
mm-hmm.
but whatever, still makes for an exciting fight. But man, he hits hard. So to land one as clean as he did, of course it's going to shatter your face. That's just what's going to happen. But that's one of the injuries that can happen on a more regular basis. The majority of decent strikers eventually get their noses broken. It's a rare situation when they don't. In this case, mangled. But I mean, that can happen. But before that, we had an event that saw two very vicious finishes.
We're going to go back in time to April 24th. You know what? We're just going to go with the Jim Crute one first.
Okay.
Because I want to save the last one for almost poetic justice, if you will. Jim Crute. This gentleman lost to Anthony Smith on April 24th due to something I didn't even know was a thing. It was nerve damage. Have you ever seen that before?
I have seen it. A while back, I've seen it happen. I've never seen it happen to that degree, though. It was such a perfect shot by Anthony Smith. Basically, a low kick that caught him in behind the knee and pretty much collapsed the nerve that runs down to his foot. And as a result of that, Jim Crute had no feeling in his foot. Couldn't plant on it. Couldn't walk properly. It just sort of flopped around. It was reminiscent of someone who would have, let's say, their Achilles snapped. That's what it looked like to me. It almost looked like his Achilles was snapped, but you could tell that wasn't exactly the case. He just completely shocked the nerve to where it wouldn't respond.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, even though Jim Crute was fine otherwise, the referee wouldn't let him come out at the beginning of the second round because he really couldn't stand. He couldn't walk.
Yeah, of course. And what weird thing is, too, is when we discuss our next incident, they were back-to-back.
Yeah, this is what makes it all the more shocking, is you see that happen, and you know it's shocking when you got, like, Rogan going, holy shit, look at that, his leg's gone. It's just gone. And then you got Cormier, who's never experienced that before, and he's just confused. And the fight ends, and they're like, oh my God, we've seen some crazy shit this UFC. His number, it was 261, by the way, Usman versus Masvidal, too. Mm-hmm. And then the very next fight is Uriah Hall versus Chris Weidman.
Which is what we want to talk about next. And Kobe, what happened there?
This is so odd in that Uriah Hall checked a calf kick by Weidman and checked it well enough to snap Weidman's leg completely.
Mm-hmm.
And the irony behind it is that's exactly what Chris Weidman did to Anderson mm-hmm. Silva to sort of begin the end of Silva's career. The exact same thing happened. Silva threw a low kick, Weidman checked it, snapped his leg. And not only do you factor in the irony behind that, it's almost like repeating history, only you're now the victim as opposed to the person who did it. But on top of that, Anderson Silva's final fight was against Uriah Hall. So it all sort of ties in together in one perfect bow, with the only thing unperfect about it is Weidman gets a trip to the hospital with a completely shattered leg.
Correct.
That image, that will stick with people, just as the Anderson Silva stuck with people. It's funny, my wife, Amy, one of the first events she ever watched was that event.
In 2013?
Yeah, when she saw Silva's leg get shattered and just flop around in the air before he went down. And it's not even the initial impact that freaks you out, because you hear the crack. You don't necessarily notice the leg wrap around as much.
Mm-hmm.
It's always the fact that after you throw a low kick, you then go back to position and plant on it. It's but when there's... they plant and you see it fold in half. That's the part that freaks people out.
Yep. Yep. But I just want to give a quick shout out to Uriah Hall for handling it like a champ. Like, that happened, and he raised great concern for Chris Weidman. As opposed to what Chris Weidman was getting flack for was when he did to Anderson Silva. He said, I just jumped on him and started pounding, because I was like, it's instinct at that point. Your opponent goes down. He was aware something happened to his leg, but he wasn't fully aware that it had broken.
Correct.
He was just like, oh, I checked it. Maybe I did nerve damage. I don't know. Either way, the champion's on the ground. I need this belt. Pound, 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 pound.
On top of that, it's Anderson Silva, right? It's one of the most impressive fighters of all time in the UFC.
Right. So there was that issue. But yeah, Uriah Hall was just sitting there and he's like, you know, I wish Chris Weidman a speedy recovery because that sucks. And then Derek Lewis chimed in on Twitter and was like, I am never throwing a low kick ever again.
That is a debate now. There's a big debate about whether or not you should or shouldn't.
Yeah.
And I mean, they had that debate and, you know, shit keeps happening.
Well, I think it's just to each their own at that point. Like, if you want to risk it, go ahead. It's effective when it's not shattering your own leg, but like, well done. Like the Conor McGregor and Poirier fight, you know, Poirier essentially won that off leg kicks for the most part.
Yeah.
Great. But you can also end your career with a leg kick. So it's really weird. It seems like an innocent little shot, but innocent it is not.
It depends. If it's employed properly, mm-hmm. you're not really putting yourself at risk.
Right.
I think what's happened is that people have seen its effectiveness in multiple situations,
mm-hmm.
and they've just gone to it now as a default against certain opponents, thinking that if I can work the leg to the point where they're having a hard time planting, I now have an advantage, although they haven't mastered the skill of how to properly utilize it.
Right.
So I think one of the best examples of leg kicks wasn't even the Poirier versus McGregor. The thing is, McGregor, his stance just opens himself up to leg kicks. McGregor has a super wide stance, his legs way out there in front of him. It's just begging to be kicked when it comes right down to it.
Right.
And he stands in such a way that it's very difficult for him to use it to check when it comes down to it too. He can't really effectively a proper check in that stance.
Mm-hmm.
The best use of leg kicks I've seen recently was the Oliveira versus Chandler.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll notice there's a couple of leg kicks that Oliveira throws. One of the first ones he throws drops Chandler on his ass. It literally scoops his leg out from underneath him.
Yeah, I saw that very early on into the fight.
That's right, because a properly thrown leg kick catches you behind your leg.
Yes.
It catches you behind it. Too often, while watching MMA now, I notice these leg kicks, they're landing on the side of the leg, which is okay. But the ones that do damage to you, to the person throwing them, is the ones that land in the front of the leg.
Yes.
Right? So you want to check a leg kick, you turn your leg out and plant, right? They catch shin to shin. But because theirs is in motion, it's got more of a chance of snapping. But if you get them behind the leg, There's no chance, none whatsoever. So I think it's just a matter of the sport has started to lean toward leg kicks as a true offensive weapon, only it hasn't gotten to the point of mastering that skill yet.
Right.
It's in flux at this point.
But I feel like it'll be done. I feel like eventually people will learn how to properly leg kick and we will have a fun time.
Oh, yeah.